Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network on the internet, broadcasting, yes, it's true, from two shipping containers outside Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show today is produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nat Wiener and sponsored by Whole Foods Market. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
We're with Groundworks. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And this show aims to bring the culture to horticulture. You can join our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants, or have a look at our website, groundworksgardens.com, to find out more about what we do. We're reaching midwinter, and while it's still cold out, we notice the trees. At least I do. I notice the swelling buds on the trees. And to me, that's always a hopeful sign of what's to come in a few short weeks.
Can't come fast enough.
I know. So today we're going to be talking about trees and their relationship with people and the urban environment with our special guest, Bill Logan. Welcome, Bill.
Hello, Bill.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Bill Logan has a very long and illustrious horticultural career. And while we personally know him as the founder of one of New York City's best arbor companies, Urban Arborist, he has accomplished much more than that. Bill Logan is and has been a certified arborist, of course, but also a teacher, an author, and a journalist. As an arborist, he's especially qualified to take care of historic landscapes and their specimen trees. As an instructor, he's on the faculty of the New York Botanical Garden and has also taught master classes for foresters in the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation.
Bill is also the man that if you need a tree removed from the back of your brownstone,
yes,
he very deftly cuts it down and carries it through without a trace of sawdust.
There's no evidence that
it
the tree was ever there.
Magic. It's magic.
We recommend him. Bill is also an award-winning author and journalist. His latest book, Oak, The Frame of Civilization, is a fascinating story about a relationship with this special species. His book, Dirt, The Ecstatic Skin of the Earth, which I love that title.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Has inspired a documentary, Dirt the Movie, which will air on PBS nationwide on April 20th at 10 p.m. Is that right, Bill?
That's right. Yes.
And that's Earth Day. Is that right?
It's just before Earth Day. But it's their Earth Day offering, I understand.
Good. Great.
Okay.
And also, Bill has had a hand in founding one of my favorite magazines, Garden Design, and has been a contributing editor for House Beautiful and a Sunday Garden columnist for the New York Times. And that's the abbreviated bio. I think that gives you a sense of the breadth of his interests and knowledge about plants and the natural world. Bill, we're so pleased to have you on our show.
I'm very glad to be here.
Great. And I'm sure that we would probably need much more than a half hour to share all your knowledge with our audience. Yes. But we're going to limit it this time to today's show to two broad topics, urban trees and the wondrous oak, the subject of your latest book. Now, the first question I have is, I once read that the average life of a New York City street tree is 7 years. Is that true? And can you tell us generally about the life of a street tree in New York City? Some of the problems, the challenges that they have.
We only have a half hour.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we can start now and go on for the half hour. New York City tree, it's a miracle that they live at all. 7 years, that's the old story.
Oh, okay.
We all pass that number around, and we see from our experience that it's closer than not. But recently, Parks has been doing new studies, and they're trying to figure out what a real life is. Partly, in the old days, it was because people would put trees in and just leave them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't really do that in a street tree pit. You can get away with it in a park, but not necessarily in a pit. So now that people are a little smarter about caring for the trees after they go into the pits, I think it's increasing the life. There's no numbers on it, but you can just see around you. You know, there's not as much just awful destruction. There's not as much things that are died back 3/4 of the way and have only got a year to live as there were 10 years ago, say.
Right.
So I think that we're moving in the right direction. I don't know. Maybe we've gone up to 10 years. But you always see in New York, like, you'll see this tree, like on State Street where I live in Brooklyn. There are all these trees that are kind of doing more or less well, some not doing so well. And then you get down to the end of the street, and there is this 32-inch diameter pin oak.
London pin oak.
And it is really happy.
Yeah.
I said, why is this one so happy? And I started looking around, and there were all these manhole covers, and the manhole covers said on them, Catskill Water Supply. Mm-hmm. So that tree has definitely got tapped into something really yummy. And you often find that you can have long lives of New York City street trees if they find some place to go.
Right.
Now, to a landscape architect, that's a little bit of a problem. Like, oh my God, they're destroying the infrastructure. But to those of us who love trees, we're going, come on,
less
get in
cement.
There, get it.
Less yes. cement, right. Exactly. And didn't they just increase the size of the street tree pit to 48
it
versus
varies.
24?
Well, there are no 24-inch ones anymore. They're,
right.
The minimum is 25 square feet.
Okay.
That's what they want as a minimum. And they're working to get bigger. Mm-hmm. And in fact, now when we're out planting street trees, you know, we always tell our clients, you know, we have to talk with parks and see how big a street tree plate we're going to make. And we'll often try to make at least 5x7, sometimes 5x8, sometimes even 5x10.
Right.
And sometimes taking great old trees that need bigger pits and gently, you know,
cutting
making
out.
A larger pit for them. And you see that the larger the pit is, the happier the tree is. Because, mm-hmm. you know, air and water is what's getting in there. And that's the main thing the trees need to make food. So if we provide them with those, they'll do much better.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some strange things done to street trees. I'm sure you have, too, in the city.
Tell us the strangest thing you've seen. Like I said, we only have 30 minutes.
Okay. Well, we've often done a wonderful project annually. Up a couple of years, they haven't done it, with a parks department called Tree Rescue, where we get sent out in the winter to deal with trees that have problems. One of the most interesting problems, and usually the problem comes because someone was convinced that they would save their tree, mm-hmm. but they were so completely ignorant of how trees grow, and mm-hmm. I'm not saying that so much as a criticism, it's a lack that happens in our time.
Right, lack of knowledge.
We had one guy who, decided that it was a bad thing for dogs to pee on trees, which is true, it is a bad mm-hmm. thing. Okay, so in order to prevent this ever possibly happening, they got sheet metal, and they sheet metaled over the entire tree pit. And then they sheet metaled all the way up the trunk to a level of about 5 feet, and then painted the whole thing a very nice kind of black, which meant right. that it also terribly overheated the tree pit.
Right.
So this poor tree was dying on the vine, and... But, you know, it wasn't done to hurt the tree.
No.
It was done to save the tree. So
yeah.
That's one of the strangest things I ever saw. And, you know, people also will, in an effort to prevent trip hazards and things like that, will think that it's a good thing to go right up to the base of the tree pit with cement.
Right.
Or in order to feed the tree, this is a very common one, to feed the tree, they will add like 5 inches of soil
on
top of the tree.
That's the worst.
And, you know, of course, that basically strangles the tree because the roots don't get oxygen.
Right,
so,
there's no air circulation.
So there are a lot of things. And I think a lot of, the more people know, that's why a group like Trees New York, like the, you know, like some of the nonprofits that have been active for many years in New York and do things like the Citizen Pruners course.
Right.
You come out of that, you know how trees live.
You
and
know.
Then you can go out and spread that because it's not complicated.
And help your neighbors on your street.
Yeah, absolutely.
Know what to do and when to prune and how to prune and not to prune themselves. And
yeah, or if they are, at least to make proper pruning cuts. It's not rocket right. science to learn to make proper pruning cuts.
Right.
If you make them, it makes all the difference to plants.
Right. As a gardener, one of the most irritating things that Carmen and I come across in our landscaping job is incorrectly planted trees. Trees that are too deep or too high. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's a problem. And believe it or not, it's a problem that not only happens in our gardens, it begins in the nurseries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we saw that too.
Yeah, I was at a wonderful conference. It was the third time they've held it at the Morton Arboretum called the Landscape Below Ground this past winter. Not this winter, but the previous one.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been looking and studying what happens in nurseries with the techniques of propagating plants. And they're finding that very often, our trees in particular, don't even have normal root flares anymore. They have an adventitious root flare, and then they have the roots coming at the bottom of that flare. So even when we plant trees at what we think is the right level in the soil, they're often too deep.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts even before people plant them. But one of the things we're always trying to get people to do is to realize that you've got to see every tree at its base has a place where it flares out a little bit.
Right.
You want to go at least to that place when you plant, not plant it deeper than that.
Right.
You plant it deeper than that, you're going to cause many problems with the trees, chiefly, again, asphyxiation of roots.
Mm-hmm.
Another way we're doing it now is to say, well, because of this problem in the nurseries with the roots being even deeper than the root flare, for mm-hmm. reasons that are too complicated to go in and do in half an hour, but they happen a lot, we're saying dig into that and see where the real first major lateral root is.
Right.
And that's where you want that first lateral root to be just at or below the surface. Mm-hmm. And then your tree will have a really good shot at life because its roots are going to get the amount of oxygen and water they need.
And it is true to plant a little higher than lower.
Higher is better than lower. Right. Though occasionally you see things that are way, way up there.
Right.
Basically, you know, the water just erodes off the bowl and then you have naked roots that die. In
knees the, sticking out of the soil, that sort of thing.
But that's much harder to do. You know?
Right.
So and the tendency is to throw them much deeper. So it's just a few measurements. And it's also when you get a tree that's in a root bowl, to dig into the ball a little bit and see exactly where that flare is and where the first lateral root is. And
right.
It makes a big difference for trees. It really does.
Right. So what tree in New York City do you wish we could see more of? Do you have a favorite?
Oh, goodness gracious. I have so many favorites. Well, there are a lot of trees I like. One is that it's a very hard street tree, and I probably wouldn't try it there. But as a park tree or a yard tree, I absolutely love Katsura tree.
Mm.
Sarsidophyllum. It's a beautiful, beautiful tree.
Yeah.
It doesn't really flower in any way that's so noticeable, but it has these beautiful kind of scallop-shaped leaves, and they change color two or three times during the year. And my favorite thing about them is that as they turn in the autumn, they smell like cotton candy.
I never noticed that.
Oh, it's
I'm
wonderful.
I'm going to have to pay attention to that.
New York Botanical Garden, right by the Watson Building, if you're walking in there. If you walk in there, and like when I begin teaching winter tree ID there, it's usually still autumn. It's usually, mm-hmm. I think, late October, early November. And I always walk the students past there, and I say, smell anything?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's two or three Katsuras right there, and mm-hmm. they all smell. And so that's a tree that I really like.
And wintertime is really a great time to study the structure of trees because you can really see their habit, their growth habit. For identification purposes.
Yes, the habit, and you can also see the buds are very clear,
mm-hmm.
It's really fun to try to identify trees in the winter. It's a little bit harder.
Because you don't have the obvious leaf.
You don't have the leaves. You know, sometimes you have persistent leaves. Sometimes you have the fruit. Sometimes you have to hunt around on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, oaks, which are really hard to distinguish, generally often maintain their leaves and other features that you can use to help identify them. But
mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun to, and you know, and also in the winter, before I was an arborist, I always thought the winter was a dead time, but I don't anymore. I mean, because you know that inside those buds, if you take a lateral cut in them and look at them with a 10 times magnifier,
mm-hmm.
you will see next year's stems and leaves already there.
Yeah.
They're just
waiting. I know, it's pretty astounding. I always do that with my son's class. So I do a fall planting and we cut open tulip bulbs and you can see the stem and the what's going to become the flower and everything already in there, and it's pretty astounding. And the winter's long here. I'm probably at the northernest parallel that I can live.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And I get excited in February when I really start seeing the swelling of the buds on the trees, and I really feel, you know, mm-hmm. like
it's coming. It really is spring. So unfortunately, right now we have to take a quick break. We're going to come right back with Bill Logan of Urban Arborist and finish up talking about the oak. We'll be back in a second.
Okay, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. You were just listening to I Am a Tree by Guided by Voices. We're speaking with Bill Logan. We were talking about street trees, and I'd like to talk a little bit now about your book, Oak, the Frame of Civilization, Bill. Tell us about how oaks and human civilizations have become so intertwined.
Oh, goodness. It's a long topic. It dates back to the end of the last ice age.
Okay.
Oak has provided us with so many things, and basically oaks kind of proceeded after the last ice age. Oaks kind of expanded, and people followed them. And you wonder why they followed them. One reason is that acorn turns out to be a very delicious thing to eat. You have to prepare it mostly. Now, if you're down in the Mediterranean region, there is an oak called Quercus ilex, which you can basically eat out of the shell.
Is that right?
Yeah. You can eat Quercus ilex out of the shell. I met a lady in Extremadura. I went to Extremadura, western Spain, to visit these things called dehesas, which are an agroforestry system that is the oldest successful agroforestry system in the world. It's been working since the oldest one they found occurred in the Neolithic, and it's places where you will have an oak forest that you basically abstract from. You don't plant it, but you just kind of weed it out, and you start pruning the trees, you start pollarding them, and you use the wood for charcoal, some of the wood you can use for structural purposes and other things. Mm-hmm. And then in the interstices, because you make lots of open land, you then can grow crops.
Okay.
And then every autumn you bring in the pigs when the acorns fall, and they eat the acorns, and you make this incredible jamon, which is now sold for like... You can now buy it in the United States at like $125 a pound. But it doesn't cost that in Extremadura, but it's extraordinarily good. All of that based on living around and through oak trees. And that's kind of a small image of what happened, especially back in the hunter-gatherer cultures. There's a thought that not only in California, where I grew up, where it's well known that the California native peoples lived on a staple diet of acorns, but also throughout the ancient Near East and in many other places, and still in Korea, the only place you can still buy acorn flour in a market is in a Korean market, because the Koreans eat acorn regularly. They eat it as a tofu and they eat it as a noodle.
There you go.
So it was a staple food for a long time in the past of the hunter-gatherer stage of our cultures.
So it predates traditional agriculture of using things like wheat and everything.
Yes, and probably in the ancient Near East was their predecessor. And arguably was a fairly sustainable way to work because it didn't use too much of anything at one time. The first agricultures were irrigation agricultures that were faced with a salt problem because they didn't understand what irrigation was doing to the soils.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you say that the oak species is not extraordinary or special. It specializes in not specializing. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, let's see. Amongst other things, there are so many species. If you ever want to start a good fight, just go into a group of oak scientists and ask them how many...
Have a beer with an oak scientist?
Have a beer. Yeah, they have little meetings, believe me. And then you meet with them and you say, how many species are there? Okay. And you will have guys throwing things at each other very shortly. And some will say, 475. And others will say, 220. The others are only just varieties. And they're all upset about this. But the thing is, oaks are so changeable and so able to adapt that they're around the world. There are more species of oaks in the Sierra Madre Mountains of Mexico than anywhere else in the world, more density of different species. The other place there are more density of species is in Southeast Asia. So you don't even think of oaks being in Southeast Asia,
no,
but there
right.
are numberless oaks in Southeast Asia. And the thought of people who think of evolution in terms of the motion of continents is that originally, the original center of diversity of oaks occurred sometime in the Cretaceous, a long, long time ago, when Southeast Asia and Mexico were basically one continent,
right.
and that they split. And then there was a spread of oaks from Southeast Asia and spread of oaks from places like Mexico. So the entire Northern Hemisphere is just full of oaks,
mm-hmm.
precisely because they're so adaptable. They aren't like, there are a lot of trees, like a garden variety redwood is bigger than any oak that's ever lived.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you can find an oak anywhere and you only find redwoods in one particular place.
Right, right.
And oak's wood is just, it's not so much that it's strong, is it's extremely adaptable. An oak can lose a branch and say, that's okay, I've got mm-hmm. plenty more, because it's always thinking up how to get around things, how to stay there for a long time. And
people should be more like that.
Yeah, and I think people modeled themselves, long ago modeled themselves on oak trees. After all, the British motto is, the reason we are who we are is because we have hearts of oak.
Right,
of course,
right.
They cut all their oak trees down.
Another show.
Well, the quercus or oak family, what interests me about it, it also has many mystical associations, right, in many cultures. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, goodness. Those are hard because they go forever. Druids, you can't really talk about. I tried. I left them out of the book basically because nothing is really known about them. Most of what's known about them is stuff that was said by their enemies or stuff that was made up in recent times by people claiming to be neo-Druids.
Right.
But it is certain that the Druid means having oak knowledge. All we know about the Druids is, for example, that they were able to recite the entire poetic heritage of their people, recite it out loud and recite it movingly and basically tell the history of the people, that they were lawgivers, that they were people who were trusted to adjudicate disputes between people. Mm-hmm. So they were people whose and you think in that way that their knowledge of oak was something that gave them a kind of steadiness and ability to choose, and also a kind of ability to pull the heritage of the people together and keep it going. You had to know many poetic meters. You had to know all kinds of things to be a druid. What you had to know specifically about oak trees, I have no idea, and neither does anyone else. But there are oaks, and I mean, the first ship ever made was supposed to be a Jason's ship, the Argo.
Jason and the Argonauts.
Right? It was supposed to have been made, at least the prow of it, and possibly the entire ship, of an oak from the grove at Dodona. Dodona is the oldest oracle in the Greco-Roman world. It's in a grove of oak trees, and the oak leaves were would speak to the priestesses and tell them what the story was. So Jason had his boat made with at least a sprig of this stuff, and it would talk as they were on their way for the Golden Fleece. It would warn them of perils, this oak. So it was said to have all kinds of oracular properties. Also, because oaks attract lightning, they were always said to be the trees belonging to Jove or belonging to Thor or belonging to, you know, gods, right, of that kind of power.
Communicating with higher powers. So what about in Latin American cultures and histories? Is there any kind of oak mythology?
Not so much, because oaks don't go very much into Latin America. They go into Central America, but that's as far as they get.
Okay.
I don't know in Mexico. I don't know, because they're mm-hmm. so common in Mexico, but I don't know what their relation to it is.
Oh, it's a new book for you.
Oh no, please. Far East would be the new book if right. I could go into the Far East.
You know, this past summer I was in Italy, and I was in a region, a part of Puglia. Italy doesn't have much forest left, for obvious reasons. But there was a place called the Foresta Umbra, a sort of last stand of ancient beech trees and also pretty ancient taxus, giant yews. Now, you know, we think of that as a pretty ubiquitous plant here, as a landscape plant. Mm-hmm. But over there, when you see them in that setting, you know, they don't have very many national parks. They do have some, but, you know, the country's the size of Florida. And their parks are many times smaller than ours. And it's only pretty recently that they've started to protect them. But according to what I read and when I visited, it really felt like a place that, you know, that it felt mystical and it felt magical to be among those giants that hadn't been cut down, you know, that had been living for many centuries. It was a really special place.
Yeah, I think it always does. I mean, and even with small trees, I mean, Alex Scheigo, who was kind of our great teacher, who was a Forest Service researcher and scientist in the 50s, who really was one of the first people to cognize exactly how trees actually live and defend themselves and changed how we as arborists work forever. His motto, and every one of his books begins with his motto, which is touch trees.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that when you touch trees, you know, that changes a lot. And you feel like you're in the presence of something alive, which lives at a different rate than you do. I often say that, you know, trees, we are to trees as dogs are to us.
It's true. Yeah.
Yes.
It's true. Yeah. So should urban gardeners plant oaks? And if so, which do you recommend? I know Carmen and I have our favorite.
Oh, my goodness. Well, there's if you're planting them in a garden, you have a lot more choices. I happen to love willow oaks. They're right on their edge of hardiness here. This is the northern, we're just beyond their northern part of their native range, but they're a beautiful stately oak that has a good central trunk, mm-hmm. like a pin oak, which is also a lovely plant. If you ever have a lot of open space,
mm-hmm.
One of the most lovely artistic uses of an LA I have seen in this part of the world is at Storm King.
Oh my God.
Where they have that double alley of pin oaks, and they take advantage. Pin oaks have the wonderful thing is their top branches are reaching for the sky, their middle branches are going out at 90 degrees, and their bottom branches are like a skirt.
Yeah.
They're facing downwards. And if you can maintain that when the trees are mature in a long alley, my goodness, is it beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a sunny spot, because if it's not sunny, you're going to lose those lower branches, and you have to work to maintain them anyway. But that's makes a pin oak a really beautiful, to my mind, an astonishingly beautiful plant. Then there's Imbricaria shingle oak, which they're planting more now. That's more of a southern plant, but it does very well here. No lobes. And if you have like open space, God, you can do red. Swamp white is a nice plant with a beautiful leaf, but grows very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
White oaks, we need more white oaks. They were much more common here, but they went because they're the whole red oak group is the wood is porous. You can make a barrel out of them, or you can make but you can't make a ship out of them, and you can't make a tight barrel, a barrel that would hold wine or something liquid.
Mm-hmm.
You have to use plants of the white oak group for that because their circulation system is stuffed up with tyloses with these things that keep it from leaking. So white oak was just decimated because it was great for ships and it was great for barrels.
It was used, right.
So putting more white oak back would be a wonderful thing, but you got to keep after white oak. It's a little harder plant to grow, but if you have a big open area, wherever you grow oak, though, it needs to have a big open space.
Yeah.
You want to try something really crazy. Marginally hardy, there's one evergreen oak, Quercus myrcinifolia.
Ooh.
And you could try it, and I've always wanted to try it. They have a couple at Morris Arboretum in Philadelphia that are doing pretty well.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I come from California where they were all evergreen, so I like myrcinifolia. Myrcinifolia in Southern California, the acorn when it's young is purple.
Ooh.
A deep, beautiful purple.
Is there a lot of hybridizing with oaks now to make them dwarf, to come up with dwarf ones or fastidiate, or is there a lot?
Oaks do it so well themselves, it's very hard to control them.
Really?
They are starting to sell some natural hybrids, like Chouettei, which is, I think, a hybrid between bicolor and Macrocarpa. Macrocarpa is another beautiful oak that has an absolutely gorgeous leaf. It's kind of deeply scalloped like the leaf of, in the maple family, like the leaf of silver maple, but it's a much stronger plant. So Macrocarpa actually is another one that would be a wonderful plant to put out there.
And of course, we have to watch out for the longhorn beetle. Is that right?
Not on oaks.
Not on oaks
no.
at all?
Not on
no?
oaks. Maples. No. Doesn't attack oaks. Maples.
It doesn't.
Maples it'll attack and a lot of other things, but it won't go after oaks, which is so.
That's interesting. I thought it went after a lot of all the hardwoods. No.
No, oaks are good. Lindens are pretty good. London planes and things and sycamores, they say, are occasionally attacked, but I think rarely so. The absolute favorite is maples.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and birches they're pretty fond of, too. Mm-hmm. So,
well, that's good to know. If people are choosing their street trees or choosing their landscape trees, it's a good, you know, people are very fond of maples.
I know.
In New York, especially Japanese maples.
Everybody, yeah. It's because it's the kind of Home Depot. Everybody, it's accessible, you know, that Japanese maple, and there's just so many other great trees, I think, out there that Bill can tell you about. So, I think that pretty much wraps up our show today, unfortunately. Thank you, Bill, so much for being our guest. And go get the book, Oaks, The Frame of Civilization, and keep an eye out for Dirt, the movie, which will air on PBS in April. And please pay attention to your street trees. They do need water. They need love. Remember to touch them. And the payoff from your street tree is immeasurable. So you've been listening to Heritage Radio Network, and we dig plants thanks to Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And Whole Foods is our sponsor today. Today's show is produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nat Wiener. Please join us on our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc., We Dig Plants, and we'll be posting the book and information on Bill so you can get in touch with him directly if you need to. Thanks again for listening. See you in the garden. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you very much.